Well, I know why
she's crying. It's because today it won't be a children's story. Tomorrow it will be a children's story again. It'll be Thistle. Tonight, I think maybe the children could follow, although there will be times when you're going to have to work at it, and maybe also the adults will have to work at it for a little while. Tonight there will be a bit of a difference, and see if I can tell you something of the difference. It will be, once again, a tale told in context. One difference is that it is not a children's story, although when we get to the actual storying of it, I'm always astonished at how sophisticated children are and how childish adults are at listening. Seriously, I think that stories are a leveler, and something levels us, and children are able to grasp some very profound things, things more profound than I even knew as I tried to work those tales up. So children, when we get to it, Mary, Talitha, other young ones, you will be able to follow, but there may be some rocky portions. The second thing that makes this different is that I'm not going to so much give you the context external to this story. This story is a novel, and it's called Waskin Mani. As I want to give you some of the internal growth of this novel. Waskin, Mani. Ingrid did excellent as she spoke it today. Waskin Mani is the name of the novel, or The Crying for a Vision. This time I will not so much tell you the experiences that I had around the creating, but I want to show you the development of it. For whatever that is worth, and whatever pleasure that may give you, it's going to give me some pleasure, to show you how it started in embryo, how it started as a seed, and to give you some sense of the steps that are taken along the way to the evolvement of a book as big as a novel. But the third reason why this is different and why I'm really going to be asking your indulgence is, well, actually there are two reasons why this is different and I'm going to ask your indulgence. One is that this is a story that I've never told before aloud, and I have never told this development before either. What's even worse to me is I'm not done with the novel yet. Where are you, Eunice? Maybe you understand what I'm talking about. This is an exceedingly dangerous thing for me. Now, I know some writers who are very, very peaceful while they're in the process of writing something to sit down with other people and read them sections and get their response. This is not my character. My character is to be intensely private about the creative process, partly because I think I'm a fool about it. This is the truth. I think I don't fully understand it, and if I let someone peep into the thing I'm doing, I would look dumb to them. I wasn't kidding. I would look dumb. And so I don't send my stuff to other people. When I started writing The Book of the Dun Cow, nobody knew I was writing a novel because I had already attempted previous novels that had failed miserably. And so I did that in much privacy until Than began to notice that I was writing all the time on it, and then it had to become evident. So this for me is a new thing. I ask your indulgence. Waskin Mani is not done. What I'm going to tell you from Waskin Mani is done. It will not feel unfinished to you. So I will not leave you hanging at the end. But this is an unpublished work. I've written one complete draft of it, and I have a profound revision yet to go on it. But it may give you some sense, just of the process itself of creation. Maybe I'll give you more sense than I understand myself. Let me give you one or two principles before I actually begin this process. And we can perhaps pursue one principle throughout this process of revealing this novel's creation to you. If I'm telling you what you already know, be kind and smile and let me tell somebody else. I don't mean to insult your intelligence. But one principle that is very significant to me is a figure called metaphor, which is the putting together, a metaphor is putting together two seemingly unlike elements, tomb, and forcing them to stand in tension one with another so that they may establish a kind of a talking dialogue. And in that talking, these unlike elements begin to reveal likeness that nobody had recognized was there before. And in that likeness, each one shines a light on the other element. Now, in poetry, that can happen very, very briefly when you say that one thing is another thing. And sometimes the poet is immediately aware of the beauty of putting these two unlike things together and immediately aware of what they reveal. In longer writing, sometimes you take a chance. You think putting these two things together is going to reveal something. It's like putting male and female together and creating children. You hope it'll work. You hope they will love each other and that they won't fight too much. And that in the process, some new thing will be born. A great deal of writing for me is serendipity. Some metaphors get put together that at first I thought would work very well, and they simply failed me. And then I have to lay all that aside and start elsewhere. Let me give you an example of metaphor, and then you will see that principle work through this whole thing of Waskamani. This is a poem. I'll set it up for you. It's called Epithalamion, which is a title that's often put upon poetry that has to do with a marriage, like a song for marriage, or upon a wedding, or upon a marriage. When I was a child, now here is the one part of this element which is metaphoric. When I was a child, I remember during the year of the cicadas. You know how the cicadas come out every 7-13 years? And all of a sudden they're all over the place. You know what a cicada is, don't you all? Things in the trees, insects. They're like locusts, but they're not locusts. They make the fan on the farm. They used to call them rears. All summer long they get in your ears with their sound. Does that make, they have a very loud sound. All right, they're kind of like locusts because they come out of the ground. They stay in the ground for years and years and years, then all of a sudden they'll come out. They will hook themselves onto bark or onto almost any standing thing. They're about this big. They have faces that look like the fronts of Mack trucks to me. Eyes very, very wide and a kind of a grill work in the middle. They look like they're hard and husky. They are. They're husky when they come out of the ground. And then they crawl up onto a tree and they fix themselves on the tree. And then what happens is down their back, the husk breaks open and out of this husk crawls a new green and very delicate creature. Same kind of face, but it's soft. Okay? And then after a while, it has to sit there. It's a very slow process as it comes out of that husk. And it sits on its own husk. And it works its wings. Its wings are all crumpled at first, and it has to fold those wings down. Long, long process. And then it finally flies away. I remember as a child once, I saw such a thing sitting on its own husk. And I touched the wing. When I touched the wing, I must have broken the vessels, the blood vessels in the wing. It didn't take much, and its blood was a green color. And it all came down inside of that wing, and it formed a drop. And to me, I had just a rush of feelings. One is that it was the most beautiful green drop I had ever seen. It made me almost gasp to see how beautiful that green could be, how very, very deep. It was like all the sea gathered into one place. It was really like an emerald. But my other feeling was such guilt and sorrow that I had made this thing to bleed. Okay? Now, experiences like that you hang on to, don't you, Eunice? And then they always lurk in the back of you waiting to find out what they mean or waiting to see what they may reveal meaning in something else. I let that become, for a marriage poem, this is in a series of poetry, one side, one element of a metaphor. Now, let's see if you can follow and see how this now stands in relationship with something that is very different from it, but as they stand in relationship, one reveals the other. This is the poem. It says, "My silent bride. Once in a lifetime, the cicada rises and splits her back. She cracks the calcified husk of an old age, the way we pop a peanut open. Once in a lifetime, she labors waveringly outside herself, her natal pale green crumpled wings unwrinkling to the weather. She leaves her shell, her image, and she flies. But a boy once touched the wing of a hatching cicada, and it bled in cellophane in terrible ease, one green drop, an emerald hung in a thin wing sack. The boy tingled, so pure, so deep, so lovely was that drop. But this was life's blood, and the same boy grieved for what he'd done. That boy was me, my silent bride. So am I now, the old cicada, young again. Elizabeth, I've split an envelope of poses, certitudes, and hard age. I've labored loving you outside myself, escaped my likeness, this calcified visage, am unwrinkling in a chill wind to fly, and lo, I bleed." So, it seems to me that that moment of marriage is charged with all kinds of feelings. the freedom that it offers and the dreadful, dreadful fear. Don't you touch me too hard. I might bleed beautiful drops for you, but they'll hurt me. That's metaphor, all right? All right, you have a principle. Please keep, I will not continue to refer to that principle as I reveal to you how this story came. But will you keep it in mind, because it works throughout this whole process. There will be at least three levels to the development of this novel. The very beginning is a kind of a metaphoric taking a story, very, very simple, in order to explain a complicated thought. The second is making the metaphor between two complete worlds. And the third is the thing that I'm going to enjoy telling you, a metaphor for painful love. I will need to give you a metaphor for painful love. Dad and I diverge here. Today he took Luke 4 and I take Luke 14 as the spiritual context for this story. In fact, that's very, very necessary. This is how it all begins. A year and 4 months ago, I was asked by the Catholic Diocese of Evansville to talk to them. They were finishing up their process of renewal. Some of you may know this thing that they've been going through, the Catholics have. It's an excellent thing. And they asked me to speak to them on discipleship. And I intended to speak very seriously to them about discipleship. I thought I would throw a Lutheran at them. Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the cost of discipleship, which is heavy stuff. I was looking particularly at Bonhoeffer's work with Luke, chapter 14, beginning at verse 25. I read it to you now. Now great multitudes accompanied Jesus. Jesus turned and said to them, "If you come after me and do not..." You know that in Matthew the word is, "If anyone would come after me and loves mother or father more than me," there's a degree. In Luke, that is not the concept. That is not the way in which Jesus talks about separation from the world. Some of you heard the word when I paused. I want you to hear the terrible viciousness of this word. "If you would come after me, if you come after me and do not hate your own father and mother and wife and husband and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even your own life, you cannot be my disciple. If you do not bear your own cross and come after me, you cannot be my disciple." Now that's what I took as my text kind of for these people. And I had concepts like this for them on discipleship. This is the spiritual context of Wask and Mani. It's worth your listening for a little while. Bonhoeffer is talking about the absolute, absolute separation between the disciple and all things of this world, even the closest things, even the dearest things. Bonhoeffer is suggesting that word hate, which in Greek is misein, is very, very significant. It means almost a repulsion, an absolute separation, and it isn't one of degree, I love Jesus more than I love Than. Rather, it is that in Jesus I am utterly separated from Than. Only the recognition of the fait accompli of Christ as the mediator between me and anything can separate the disciple from the world of people and things. It is the call of Jesus regarded not as an ideal, but as the word of a mediator which effects in us this complete breach with the world. If it were only a question of weighing one ideal against another, we should naturally hanker after compromise. In that case, the Christian ideal might come out on top, but its claim could never be absolute. We cannot establish direct contact outside ourselves except through Jesus. Through Jesus' word, through our following of him, to think otherwise is to deceive ourselves. But since we are bound to abhor any deception which hides the truth from our sight, we must of necessity, now listen to this please, repudiate any direct relationship with the things of this world, family, friends, yea, and even our own lives. And that for this, I'll read that again. We must of necessity repudiate any direct relationship with the things of this world, and that for the sake of Christ. Wherever a group, be it large or small, prevents us from standing alone before Christ, wherever such a group raises a claim of immediacy, immediate relationship to me, it must be hated for the sake of Christ. For every immediacy, whether we realize it or not, means hatred of Christ. Immediacy means no mediation between me and the other one. Christ does not stand in between. It means I push Christ out of that.
And this is especially true where such relationships claim the sanction of Christian principles.
All right, and then he also speaks, Bonhoeffer also speaks in there of the real, real suffering, the painful suffering which such love of Jesus, this is the cross business, requires, and that such suffering is, in effect, killing. It is the suffering itself which divorces me, yea, even from my own life. Now, I don't mean to give you the whole speech that I gave them, but I wanted you to hear some of the principles which were behind it. I remember that I always get nervous when I talk. I cannot get over that. I pray to God that I could get over it, and God just laughs at me, and I get nervous. And so I went to, they had a big meal, first of all, you know, and they thought that was really nice, that we were going to have a big meal, and I would enjoy all this shrimp and fish. I love fish. I love shrimp, and I couldn't hardly eat a bite. And then when it was all done, it was getting set for me to give this extraordinary speech on difficult matters. Then they put a record on of a monk singing a song. And I waited, and it was a very long song. I think it was 6 minutes long. There's a reason why I'm telling you this, because while that song was going on, I thought to myself, I cannot just tell these people these concepts alone, cold, bare naked like this. I said, I've got to dress it somehow. This is true. I said, I have to dress it somehow so that maybe so that I can ambush them. I can kind of come up below and subvert them. You know how it is, just come up below and pinch them in their butts. And then they'll see that I was talking some heavy stuff, but they didn't know. And so I said, I'll tell them a story. What story can I tell them? And so I made one up. In 6 minutes, I made a story up. This is metaphor at its first level. I'm going to tell you the story I told them. You will see how it fits some of this stuff. This is just parabole. Parable is metaphor. This is parable. Parabole means what? To throw alongside of. Two things thrown one side along the other. My story was to help them to understand the absolute resignation that the disciple must go through in the complete love of Jesus Christ. All right? All right. And I put it on four levels in my head. I mean, you can make stories very simple. Stories are wonderful things, people. If you just get the elements at first and you get up and the people are listening to you, you could go on. And then you get inside that story yourself and you enjoy telling it. I got in it and I enjoyed it. I'll get into it yet. Here I come. Okay, I said there was an Indian woman. I don't know why I picked Indian. I know why I picked Indian. Because I wanted her to love a horse. And I wanted the horse to be wild. And I wanted the meeting to be serendipitous. So I picked an Indian woman. I said there was an Indian woman. And I had her standing... If any of you have been in the Badlands, I had her standing in the Badlands on a ridge. I said she was standing on the Badlands in a ridge, on a ridge. And it was a beautiful day. It was an azure sky. It was a completely scrubbed blue sky. And she was standing on this ridge. And while she was standing on the ridge, she saw far off to the right a bit of a dust go up into the air. Now you know how far and far you can look in the Dakotas, huh? And some of the edges of the Badlands, there you can see the horizon at a distance, and she saw some dust go up. And it was a bit of a red color. I said it was the rouge. It was a bit of a rouge smeared on the heavens as it went up behind. And it was dust. And it caught her eye. And she became curious at this dust that was rising up far, far on the horizon. And then as she stood there and she saw this dust come, she could feel a kind of a trembling in the ground, just a bare trembling, hardly feel at all. And when it got nearer and nearer, It was a horse. It was a coal black stallion. It was a beautiful horse. And it took her eyes. She forgot she was standing on a ridge. It was as though she was right there next to the horse itself. That's what I said. And I said that horse was to her marvelous. She watched it come. And do you know the dust went up behind it like a red cloud that began to hang like a painting on the sky. And when the horse came, it loved to run. I don't know if you've ever watched a horse that loves to run, but this horse did. That is, for a while, it'll strain its muzzle out, it'll strain its head, it'll make its neck flat with the ground, and it'll pound that ground hard as it can with its hooves. And then all of a sudden, it'll pull up and prance. It'll leap into the air like that, if you've seen it. It's the joy of prancing, so that the shocks of the hooves on the ground are like thrills that go up into the show. She watched that horse do that with its mane leaping up into the air and its tail. And the woman loved the horse. Now, I don't remember if in my first telling of the story this is what happened, but it's worth it, so it happened. The horse ran, or pranced, or galloped. It just took sheer pleasure in the blueness of the sky and the redness of the dust and the hardness of the earth. It ran up to where she was. And the sun was behind her. Of course it was. And it cast her shadow out onto the ground. And that beautiful black horse came and looked at the woman, which shocked her with self-recognition. Went shooting through her like tingling, that this horse, can you imagine what you've seen in a distance, how huge it is when it stands right in front of you, looked at her with an eye and stepped on her shadow. And she felt it. She felt that step, as it were, on her. And she loved that horse. Now, in stories, you can get away with that. She loved the horse. And it was as though the horse lifted and tossed its head like this in freedom, in absolute and utter freedom. And that hurt the woman. The freedom of the horse, whom she loved so much, hurt the woman, and it ran on. And in her heart, she said, I've got to have that horse. I love that horse. I must buy that horse, she said. Now, this is only a parable, and I was only making it up, so I made it easy on myself. She went to, don't call them medicine men. Call them sacred men. Call them holy men. And she found a holy man. All right? And she was just brimful, just full of the passion of love for this black horse. She couldn't get out of herself the thrumming through her bones of how it ran on the soil. She couldn't get the beauty of the thing out and its own pure joy and freedom. And she couldn't get out of her mind the fact that it had looked her in the eye. Oh, you know the power of looking her in the eyes. And so she went to this holy man and she said, I want to buy this horse. And the holy man said, who owns it? And she said, I don't know. I think it's free. The holy man said, you're right, it owns itself. She said, what will it take for me to buy this horse? I must have this horse above all things. And the holy man said, how much do you love the horse? And she said, with all my heart, with all my soul, with all my mind, and with all my might. And the holy man said, then it will take everything to buy this horse. She said, I can do that. I can do that. I'll sell everything that I have, and I'll buy it with the money for that. And so she rushed back to the camp where the teepees were and where her tribe was and her families. And she got every single possession that she could possibly have. All the clothing, beautiful white buckskin dresses that she had. Even the extra buckskin and the parfleches that she had and the food. And she sold it all. She sold everything that she could put her hands on in a rush of joy. And she came rushing back with a little pile of some kind of, I don't know what it was because I was just making the story up, some kind of money. And she put it down in front of the holy man and she said, there, everything I have. Now let me buy the horse. And the holy man said, this isn't enough. She said, not enough. This is all that I have. This is everything that I have. The holy man said, who owns the horse? She said, the horse owns itself. The holy man said, how much do you love the horse? She said, with all my heart, with all my mind, with all my soul, with all myself. The holy man said, then you have more that you must give up. What? This is all I have on the outside, she said. And he just gazed at her, and his eyes went to the inside. And she said, oh, my inside, my worth on the inside, my talents, my abilities. The holy man, they stop talking at certain points. They just wisely nod. And so she went home, and she had profound talents, did this woman. She was filled with a talent. She could work with porcupine quills, and she could do fine bead work, and she did this day and night. She did it till her hands wore down, till they were bleeding. She used profound art and skill to make things so beautiful, and she sold all that she made, and she piled up a little pile until she was utterly exhausted. You must understand this, until she was empty inside as she was empty outside, totally empty. And she came back to the holy man with a little bit bigger pile and laid it in front, and she said, all I have. Can I buy the horse? And the holy man shook his head and he said, not enough. And she said, what else is there? He said, how much do you love this horse? She said, I told you, all my heart and all my soul and all my mind. And the holy man said, when you go home, is there any treasure that you will find there? Is there anything there that you find it hard to do without? And she said, oh. And she went home, and her two children ran out to meet her. And they threw their arms around her, and it was like weighing a kind of a love, because she loved these children so dearly. And yet there was this horse Now I tell you, this is a paradox, and there is no explaining this, but there was this horse that she would own, and she had two treasures in her children. It was painful. You must imagine that it was painful, but her two running and laughing children she gave to her sister who had no children at all, who lived in the teepee, whom the children knew, but she gave them to the sister. And she said to the sister, "You are their mother now. You are their mother now." And she took what she had from that, and she went back and she laid it behind before the whole, tears in her eyes, because there is such a heavy division between those things. And she said, "This is all that I have, outside, inside, and all my relations." And the holy man looked and he said, "Not enough." She said, "Not enough. What else is there?" The holy man said, "How much do you love the horse?" She said, "I love the horse with all my self." And the holy man said, "That's right, self. You must also be done with yourself." Now the way in which this story ended, here's a leap, was that the two children wondered day after day, year after year, about their mother and what had ever happened to their mother. Why hadn't they seen their mother for so long? Oh, they loved their aunt who became their mother and they called her mother, but where had their mother gone? Even as there had been a profound question in the woman's mind, if I am not here, how can I own anything? If I give up myself, how can I own the horse which I love? That's a terribly huge question. One day, when the two children had grown partway to adulthood and were walking on a plain underneath a ridge, they saw a horse come running, a beautiful, beautiful black horse. And as it came close to them, it slowed down and it gazed them in the eye. And it stopped right in front of them. And it was a mare. And they looked into the eyes of this horse. And they saw their mother. And it ran. That was my story. My story, as you can see, you can stretch it, pull it, push it, it's parable. It says that finally what happens is that you do not own the object of your love. What happens is you dwell within the object of your love. Or the object of that love, as it is the Christ, dwells also within you. It was not a complete story. I know that. There are all kinds of problems with that story. Technical problems, as well as other problems. But I came to love that story when I told it. I liked it. And I think it was also because I liked the problem that was posed by that story. And I thought, I won't forget this. I'm going to remember this one. I'm going to expand this one. And that was the beginning. Serendipity, metaphor. I had chosen Indian out of the blue. I knew very little about Indians at that time. I want now to expand this story, and I wanted to make it more realistic, less parabolic, less thrown one thing beside the other. I wanted it to have that sense of the constant loss of self until self is totally found within another, and so that it finally isn't an issue of possession at all, that it is an issue of love, and that it is an issue of relationship. And I wanted to pursue it even after that a little bit, after the time when the woman is found within the horse. So I thought it is necessary for me, now here is where you just have to kind of work with me. It's necessary for me to understand Indian culture. I wanted to make this realistic enough that people would care about what was happening. And I wanted to know if it was right. Is it possible for somebody, could it have been possible for someone to love a horse that much in the Indian culture? And serendipity. Now remember, here's where the metaphor is. I'm thinking of the Christian way of life, and suddenly we have the Indian culture here, and I thought, well, these two things fit together. I found a book by accident. I recommend it to you. I talked about it last week. It's called The Sacred Pipe by Black Elk, although Black Elk does not speak English. Black Elk was a holy man for the Oglala Sioux Indian of South Dakota, Eastern Montana, so forth and so on. This book gives seven rituals of the Oglala Sioux Indians. And while I read that book, my mind just went boom, boom, boom at the beautiful, beautiful kinship. I think, this was not a hard metaphor, the kinship which exists between some of the profoundest truths of the Christian faith and the vision of the Oglala Sioux Indian. Oh, dear people, if you don't know that vision, you ought one day to walk into it and to dwell there. I mean it. Ephesians talks about the unity of all things. all things finally being bound up in Jesus. The Oglala Sioux Indian know the unity of all things. Let me tell you, let me fix the world, because this became the world of my novel. And I saw my perception of the Christian faith to take human blood and warmth and blessing and to involve all of creation into it. We have a kind of a habit, I don't know where this comes from, of spurning creation, huh? We talk creation when we talk about the creation narrative, and then we kind of forget it. We zero in on people. We forget all the beautiful, profound, revealing, manifest things of God's creation. Well, the Oglala Sioux don't. When they pray six directions. And each direction has a meaning. And in their prayer, when they pray those six directions, do you see the lovely thing that happens? They find themselves at the center of all the world. And do you know what is at the center of the world? Why, the great God, Waskinmani. But Waskinmani, that is the great spirit, the most holy one, also shapes the whole world. It's a wondrous image. Now, I have to pause a second. I had to do two things in my novel. I had to make two profound changes. One is that I had to give up the woman for a man. Sorry. But that's okay. You watch. It'll be balanced beautifully. I had to give up my woman in the story. I find I often tend to take a woman. But I had to, in order to fit with the Oglala Sioux Indian culture, I had to take a man. His name is Waskinmani, which means in Lakota, that is the tongue, which means in Lakota, moves walking. Moves walking. This became my central figure in the story. But here was the thing that I discovered. I discovered how much the feminine principle and the masculine principle work together in the Oglala Sioux Indian understanding of spirituality and this world. It really is extraordinary. So I no longer had a wise man, I had an unchi. I had a grandmother whose wisdom was there. Now let me sketch that universe for you. When they pray first to the west, which is the place where the thunder beings come from. The thunder beings are the firebirds or the thunderbirds. They are the lightning. They are the storm. They are the demiurge. They are the power of the universe. They are these things that overwhelm humanity. But the Indians are able to stand and to face those wild thunderstorms and recognize a kinship. That is marvelous. It does not terrify them. They understand it. The thunder beings come from the west. They pray to the north. They pray to the north. From whence come the white winds and the white purifying snows. All things work together for good. And the snows come out of the north that they pray to. And they understand the purification that winter is. That has something also to do with their purification rites. Sweating, jumping into the snow, sweating. They pray to the east, whence the star of wisdom comes. The morning star is where wisdom rises every morning. There's something right in that. That in the morning when that bright star comes, it is the teaching star. It is the calling star. It says to them in siren voice, in sweet violin voice, if you can hear a star, it says, wake, wake and understand. They pray to the south, out of which the warmth comes. And now listen to this. They pray to the earth. And the earth's name is Unchi. Unchi means grandmother. Unchi. Grandmother, because the earth nourishes all life, and they are one together with all life. The two-leggeds, the four-leggeds, and the wingeds. That's how they divide life. Our brothers and sisters together. And grandmother Unchi supports all life. Unchi is often red. If you see the dust as it goes into the sky out there, it's red. Now, dear people, understand the beauty of this thing. When they talk to their grandmothers, what do they call their living grandmothers? They say to the white hairs, they say, Unchi. When they talk to the earth, what do they say to the earth? They say to the great round earth, they say, Unchi. Now, when they speak to the earth, it is a living thing because it is the same name and it participates in the same being as their grandmamas. It is a living thing which responds. When they lie in the grass, the earth holds them and folds them. I think there's truth to this. When they speak to their grandmothers and say Unchi, then the grandeur of the earth, which supports the cottonwood trees, which they call the whispering trees, which cottonwood trees all day long put their branches up in praise to Waskinmani, or to Wakantanka. The bright earth which supports those trees is what they think of when they say, "Onchi to the white hairs." Can you see what a beautiful binding together that is and how real it is? The sky is Tunkashila, Grandpa. Tunkashila, Grandpa. Now you please must understand, this is not a polytheistic universe. These are manifestations of the deity, or these are places in which the deity acts. It is a single monotheistic universe because Wakantanka, they say, was and is and always will be. And for me, this is a wondrous way of finding these two elements bound together, the masculine and the feminine, without saying, but one is a god and the other is a god, as we have in the old pagan religions, but rather realizing that the creation of God does sing the praises of God. Oh, well. Those are the other two directions, below and above. And for me, then, in my story, what I found was Onchi. Oh, did I love Onchi. Onchi, this is where metaphor just pow works for me. Onchi was the earth talking. But Onchi was a true character, is now, in this novel which I am writing, a true character whom I love. She is so wise. She is also dumb. I mean, you know, when you love, you make mistakes. And the earth makes its mistakes, and my Onchi makes mistakes for Waskinmani, but she is also wise. And I have seen this Onchi grow for me in this story. All right, so that became the background. I'm getting very excited telling them about this. I hope that's all right. That became the background. I used the Oglala Sioux Indian culture. Waskinmani became the one who loved the horse. And I had no problem with steps 1, 2, and 3. I had no problem with Waskinmani selling all the goods. There's a lot of stuff I'm going to skip in this novel, which I think you would really like, but I'll have to skip it. No problem with Waskinmani selling bows and arrows and so forth and so on. I also had no problem with Waskinmani emptying himself of his talents. And also, Waskinmani had a beautiful sister whose name was Wasusnawin. Wasusnawin, rattling hail woman, whom he gave away in marriage. And his Bunchi was the other relative that he had to give away. But I had a problem. And I needed a metaphor. How could I write into my book the sweetness and the terrible pain of a love which finally kills the self? How could I do that? And how could I do it in such a way that secular minds as well as Christian minds could understand it? Let me repeat this, because here is the turning point in my talk to you. I had a problem. Where could I find an image or a metaphor for that love which was so sweet and terribly painful that finally it kills the self? Do you understand the heaviness of this thing I'm telling you? That love, so sweetly and terribly painful that it finally kills the self, that the self may live totally in its beloved and that the beloved may become the self. I didn't know. I couldn't just have Waskinmani do some stupid thing like suicide. I couldn't do something like that. That would be out of... And this is partly a fantasy novel. Well, for me it was a long problem, and that's some of the joys of writing. When you've got a problem and you know you're going to find some kind of a solution and it's going to be creative and it's going to surprise the dickens out of you, out of me, and it did. I got the answer. Now remember my church I told you about yesterday, this beautiful church teaches so much. I got the answer from Mary Moore, my friend Mary Moore, whose grandmama has been dead longer than I knew. I didn't know her grandmother, but I know Mary and I know her mother. And Mary is so quiet, and she told me the story of her grandmother. And Mary Moore's mother's name. Can you think I can tell that? Is Stella? Just to tell you, these people, her name is Stella. The reason her name is Stella is because it's really Australia. Her mother named him after continents. But you should meet Stella. If you want to hear black talk, straight black talk, and hear all the images that are in black talk, all the metaphors that come, it's poetry. You should listen to Stella. Come visit us. But don't, you know, just kind of lurk around Stella. She'll shut up if she thinks you're listening. Mary Moore, gentle spirit, told me about her mother, grandmother. This is what happened. Her grandmother lived in the projects. Projects are built out of brick. I don't know if any of you know this very simple thing, but in the daytime, brick gets hot. And by nighttime, the brick is terribly, terribly hot. It bakes you. It is not cool until 2 or 3 in the morning. You wonder why in the cities and in the inner cities, especially where we have been so kind to give the poor people projects to live in, you wonder why it is that the kids are out on the street until 2? It's because in those wonderful projects of brick, they bake. It's hot in there under the sun. And so they're out. Well, Mary Moore's mother, grandmother, who had a strong personality, would go into her house at the right time. But what she would do is make up a pallet for herself in front of the screen door. And then she'd leave the inner door open, and she'd sleep here so that the breeze would come and cool her. One night, she lived alone. One night in 2 rooms, she was lying on her pallet inside of the screen door. And a man came. The man had a knife. He put his knife through the screen door and he cut down the screen like that. The man had not counted on Mary Moore's grandmother. Mary Moore's grandmother was not about to let anybody into her house. The woman was right there in front of the man when he stepped inside. He went like this and what? And here was a woman. She rose up in front of him like that and began to beat on him, began to fight him, which shocked the guy. He had a knife though. It was a serrated edged kitchen knife. And he stabbed her. He stabbed her here, in her chest. And in the fight that went on between the two of them, the knife broke off and left the blade on the inside. He took the knife butt and he ran. And she felt that she had been triumphant. She had. She'd fought that guy off, but there was a blade in her. Mary says that all the family said, "You've got to see the doctor." Now, this is years and years ago. She had her reasons, you may imagine what they are, for not going to see any doctor at all. She was not going to see a doctor. She said, "Am I bleeding? Oh, is this a little bit of a cut there where the blade had gone in and out?" She wasn't bleeding. She said, "Fine, put some alcohol on it." She put some alcohol on it, and she would not see a doctor. Well, she lived 10 years after that with a knife blade in her chest. This is what Mary told me. Only after 10 years, for one reason or another, the knife blade began to move inside of her. And now she did go to the doctor because she was spitting blood and she was coughing blood. When she went to the doctor, they would take an x-ray and they would see the knife blade maybe here. And then she's breathing, right? She's moving. And a little while later, they'd take an x-ray and they'd see the knife blade over here. And they were desperate. They didn't know where to cut in, between which ribs. How would they get to the knife blade? They couldn't do anything. It was moving all on its own. It was moving with her breathing alone, and it killed her. That's how Mary Moore's grandmother died. She told me that story, and it became my metaphor. I began to understand the love, which is both sweet and painful, but as it moves, it kills itself unto goodness. Now I will tell you what Unchi told Waskinmani. And you will see these metaphors work. Okay, kids, turn your ears. Waskinmani was sitting outside of the teepee at night, and he was angry, and he was bitter, and he was crying. He was crying for tears, because he had given up as much as he thought he could possibly give up, and he still could not purchase this horse, which was free and unto itself. And it was his Unchi who came to him at that point. His Unchi who came. And she said what you know the Sioux say. She said, "Pay attention." Little tiny woman comes to great Waskinmani with his loincloth like this. And she says, "Pay attention, pay attention." She's going to tell a story. She said, "Waskinmani, it's like, where does this pity come from? Where does this self-pity come from, Waskinmani?" Waskinmani's mother is dead. Unchi is the one that Waskinmani listens to. "Pay attention," she says. She says this in my story. She says, "Black Elk and I married," she said, "and we had 10 good years together, Black Elk and I," she said. "And then he died," she said. She said, "Pay attention, Waskinmani. Listen to this, Black Elk is your grandfather." She said, "Black Elk loved me and stood tall. And you knew Black Elk among all of the people because you would hear his laughter." When she said, "Tunkashila laughed like the thunder." Black Elk, when he looked at anything that was a little bit twisted, could laugh so hard that it went back into shape again. And I loved him, she said, and we had 10 good years together. Pay attention, she said. One night, Black Elk and I were lying on our pallet in the teepee. Perfect darkness. People, do you know perfect darkness? I guess you do out here. Not in the city, but out here. In perfect darkness, we were lying side by side. And all of a sudden, Black Elk sat up in bed, or in the pallet, and he said, Crow, Crow Indians. And I listened, and I could hear it too. The Crow had come to the horses, and Black Elk was listening to see whether or not the guards, the Lakota guards, would fight the Crow off or send him off or whatever, and he heard nothing. All he heard was the whispering and the motion of the Crow out by the horses. Instantly, Black Elk was up and on his feet. With nothing but a loincloth, he ran out of the teepee, and I followed him. I followed him behind, and we went around to where the horses were corralled, and we saw two Crow Indians, both of them on horses, and they were just about to release the horses of the Lakota. Well, Black Elk let them know that he was there. He had no weapons. He stood there in his nakedness, and he went, Hiya! Hiya-ya-ya! Which is a kind of an announcement that they would fight, and he was here. And the two Crow Indians wheeled the horses around, and they saw one man standing there without any weapons at all. And I didn't know what to do, and I stood back, and I made the ululation for Black Elk. I started making the ululation to give him courage as they came, because all of a sudden, these two Crow Indians rode their horses hard as they could down on Black Elk, and Black Elk stood his ground. They came, so that the ground thundered. Wask and Mani, pay attention, the ground thundered, and I did not know what Black Elk would do. But at the last minute, as the first Crow warrior came, Black Elk leaped into the sky and threw himself crossbody against the warrior. So off, he sheared that Crow off the back of the horse, and they went down on the ground together. Wask and Mani. Black Elk was on top of the Crow, and he had his forearm on the Crow's throat, and he was pushing because he would push the breath of life out of him. He was pushing, but he didn't see what I saw. I was making my ululation, and I looked and I saw the other Crow warrior wheel his horse around. And he pulled his horse to a stop, and he reached into his quiver, and he pulled out one long arrow, and he notched it. And I saw him aim, and I shrieked, Black Elk! But he didn't move, because the Crow released the arrow, and it shot right up Black Elk's back. Black Elk went up standing like this. He didn't make any sound, but his mouth was open, as though he were like a bear, shouting. And I lost my senses. I lost my senses. I ran to the other Crow that was getting up off the ground, and I picked up a stick and I started to beat that Crow. I beat that crow for what they had done to Black Elk. I beat that Crow and I screamed and I cried, and that Crow Indian went down, and I didn't stop beating it. He died, and I kept beating him. I kept beating him because of what he had done to Black Elk. And the people came out of our village and they stood around with their mouths open at this woman who was beating a Crow warrior to death. But I couldn't stop because I was so angry at what he had done to Black Elk. And then all of a sudden came round me an arm. And it was only one arm could stop me from beating that Crow. And I smelled him. It was Black Elk. He was not dead. He was standing there with his arms around me, and I smelled him. I smelled his smell. And that's why I went quiet. And I just relaxed, and I let him hold me. He was alive. Black Elk was alive. That night when we were back into the teepee again, I had to pull the arrow out of Black Elk. He lay on his stomach, and I took a good hold of the shaft. Oscar Mani, I could not pull it. I have pulled arrows out, but I could not pull this arrow out. With all my might, I pulled and I pulled, and then all of a sudden it broke free like this. And when I pulled it out, I understood why. The flint had stayed in. The flint was inside of Black Elk, lodged in a bone somehow under the shoulder. And I showed the arrow with its hanging thong and its blood on it to Black Elk, and he looked at it, and he nodded, and we said nothing. He lay back that night, and he took a little tunke, little knick-knick, and a little tobacco, and he smoked, and then he went to sleep. He had a scar down here, just a little scar, and we forgot his scar, and we had 10 good years. Wask and Mani, pay attention. We had 10 good years. There came a day in the buffalo hunt. Waskinmani, Black Elk came back from a hard ride on the buffalo hunt. He used to ride just with his legs alone. He would ride up on the left side of the buffalo, and he would shoot so hard his arrows would pass through. He was strong, and he laughed long, and he laughed loud. I knew of no one, Waskinmani,
who could ride a horse and shoot a buffalo and laugh all at once. But Black Elk could because he had such joy in it. But that night when he came back, he was coughing. And it was blood at his lips. It was blood. And I noticed in the morning when he woke up that there was a crust of blood all around his mouth like this. And one night while we were lying there, he was on his back and he touched me. And I looked and he tapped his chest. Waskumani, I knew the flint was loose in him and the flint was moving. I knew because it was loose in me too. Pay attention, Waskumani. This was my love for Black Elk. That the flint in him was the love in me, and the love in me was the flint in me, and when it moved in him, it moved in me, and I felt it. Now he should not ride after the buffalo. Now he should not fight or count coup with the other Indians. Now he should most especially not laugh, because when he did these things in the night, he would lie beside me, and he would tap his chest. And it was a different place, and I knew because the pain was traveling in its own flint. It was my love. I knew that the flint was traveling and that it had moved. Waskumani, it was moving toward our heart, said Wunshi. And then Wunshi said, Waskumani, it was your mom. It was Ina, your mom. One day I was standing outside of the village and I looked into the hills and I looked into the trees and I saw this little girl, and it was our daughter. It was our child. She was all painted up so fierce. She had the yellow jagged lines of lightning going down her leg. She had an arrow sticking up behind her head. She had a little wooden bow and a little wooden hatchet, and she was creeping through the woods. Warrior she was. She was a warrior, and she had a whole dead mouse hanging beside her ear. And behind me was Black Elk, and he was watching too. And while we watched, there came a dog up behind your mama, our daughter. And every time she took a step, big brave warrior, the dog took a step. And it was as though the dog wanted to play the game too, but the dog wasn't sure what kind of game this was. So the dog asked. The dog said, "Woof!" And when the dog said, "Woof!" your mama shot up into the air, and the dog shot up into the air, and your mama went running one way with mice and hatchet and bow and arrow, and the dog went running the other way, and Black Elk started to laugh. He laughed so hard, he laughed like the thunder. He said, "Oh, daughter, you are Lakota," he said, "so frightened, but it was only a dog. So frightened, then you run from the dog," said Black Elk, and he laughed, and I stopped laughing. I said, "Black Elk, no!" I said, "Black Elk, don't!" And he could not stop laughing. This was Black Elk. He laughed and he laughed till the tears came to his eyes over your mama, Waskumani. And I ran up behind him. He laughed and I beat him on his back. I beat him for the thing that he was doing, because all of a sudden in his laughter, the blood shot out of his mouth. And I didn't know then whether it was the gargling or vomiting or laughing, because he went down to his knees and I was hitting him. And then I couldn't stop hitting him. And finally, I put my arms around him, and it was smile on his face, and it was blood. And he looked up at me then, Waskumani, and he touched his heart. And he nodded. And we died. Waskumani, I kissed his lips, and I took his blood, and we died. Waskumani, you love a horse. With all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. The love is a flint, child. The love is a flint that travels with you as it travels with the horse. And one day it shall touch your heart as it touched mine. But I will tell you this. When I kissed Black Elk and when I took his blood, then even as I died with him, Waskumani, pay attention. So he lives in me. And I have kept him in me all these years. Your love is a flint, child. Your love is a flint. Tomorrow, a children's story.